Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the James at Ohio State. The best outcomes for treating cancer come from early detection. The James Cancer Diagnostic Center is designed to provide rapid evaluation and a clear diagnosis to those who suspect they have cancer. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/diagnosticcenter.
Welcome to All Sides with Amy Jurevich. This is Untangled, a show from All Sides and WOSU that takes a complicated topic and untangles it for you, explains it in a way that's easier to understand. This season, we're untangling the cost of learning. Countries like Denmark, Finland, and Sweden are consistently ranked among the best for educating children. Singapore and South Korea are known for having school children with the highest test scores. But where does the K-12 public education system in the United States fit in? And is money the sole factor in determining how good an education system is? According to the Learning Policy Institute, a nonprofit independent research think tank, there's a large body of evidence showing that money, when spent equitably and effectively, does improve student outcomes. But how do other countries pay for that education? Joining us now is Linda Darling Hammond, the Chief Knowledge Officer for the Learning Policy Institute. Linda was also the founding president and CEO of the organization for 10 years. Linda, welcome to All Sides.
Great to be with you.
So I found a lot of different lists from a lot of different places out there that have listed the best countries for educating children. Some of the lists had the United States on it and some did not. So how is the United States K-12 system viewed in the eyes of the world?
Well, one of the ways that people rank countries is using the international assessments, the PISA, the Program for International Student Assessment. And on that test, the United States ranks about sixth or seventh in reading out of about 80 countries, and about 12th in science, but way down near 30-something in math. So depending on the subject area, you would get a very different answer. And our rankings have gone up, but that's partly because most countries' test scores went down significantly more than ours during the pandemic. And I think it was because of the American Rescue Plan Act that put, you know, a lot of resources into our schools that we didn't have quite as big a hit from the pandemic as other countries.
So I found a paper from your organization called the Learning Policy Institute. The paper's called How Money Matters, Education Funding and Student Outcomes. And in the paper, it says that money, when spent equitably and efficiently on key school resources, does improve student outcomes. I feel the key words there are equitably and efficiently. Does the U.S. struggle in these areas?
We do. We inherited a very inequitable funding system in the United States. Each state does its own thing. Many of them have local communities with local property taxes as the main driver of funding. So I would say in a majority of states, we still have the more affluent districts providing more money for their students than the least affluent districts. There are states that have equalize their funding, that have turned that around, you know, centrally determined the funding, putting more money where kids have greater needs. And in those cases, the studies show that achievement has gone up and the achievement gaps have narrowed because of that change in the funding system.
So that same paper looked at poverty rates in many countries, and the countries that are doing better, quote unquote, better in education have lower poverty rates. So one big issue in the U.S. is that the United States has one of the highest child poverty rates among developed nations. Talk to me about how that impacts education funding.
It has a huge effect. Our safety net in this country is very tattered. And so not only do we have higher rates of child poverty, in fact, a majority of public school students qualify for free and reduced price lunch as low-income students. And that's been increasing. And so part of it is that we don't have a safety net for students that provides them with health care and, you know, stable housing and nutrition and these higher poverty rates. And that means that schools have to pick up a lot of those costs. Schools in this country are providing food and, you know, health care and lots of supports for students. There are a sizable proportion of students that has been growing who are homeless. All of those things, of course, impact your ability to learn. And schools in this country have been picking up the costs of those challenges so that they can educate kids.
So are you saying that in most other developed nations, the social services part, even the food, paying for lunch and breakfast, most other nations don't do that?
Well, some of them do provide a free meal. Finland is very proud of that, but they don't need to do it because kids will not otherwise get a meal. They do it because they want that to be part of the school. And not only do we have many more costs for the needs of children that are unsupported socially, but because most of those countries also have universal health care, they have universal retirement systems. They don't have to pay for the healthcare costs that our districts have to pay for, which is about 15% of the school budget is just paying for health insurance for employees and for kids. And then they don't have to pay for pensions, which is another huge part of the budget in many, many states. So they can spend their money specifically on education.
Okay, so you're saying that here in the United States, school districts have to pay for a lot of things that other countries don't have to. So they pay for the health care. You're talking about for the teachers and staff, right? And then
Yes.
they pay into a pension system so that the teachers have a retirement plan. But in other countries, the federal government takes care of that. Is that what you mean?
Right. Yeah, that's right. That's part of the social safety net that the country has built for its citizens generally.
This is Untangled from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking about school funding in the U.S. compared to other countries with Linda Darling Hammond, the Chief Knowledge Officer for the Learning Policy Institute. You wrote a book many years ago about teacher education around the world. Does the United States prepare its teachers well compared to other countries?
Well, we have some excellent teacher education programs, but once again, we don't provide that preparation equitably. So in the United States, you get as much preparation as you can afford to pay for yourself. Whereas in other countries that are high achieving countries, teacher preparation is free, it's high quality, everyone gets it, everyone gets as much as they need. In Finland, you'll get a 2 or 3 year master's degree that is almost like a medical training to become a teacher, completely at state expense, and in some countries with a salary or a stipend while you're going to school. In the United States, you have to figure out how to go into debt to go into a profession which then pays you about 25% less than other college educated professions will pay. And that means a lot of people come into teaching with very little preparation. Or they try to get prepared while they're teaching on an alternative credential. I came into teaching that way because I could not afford to figure out how to take a master's degree in teaching at that time in my life. And so that's not uncommon. But then what happens is that a lot of those folks don't stay in the profession, don't manage to get fully prepared, and they are distributed to the students who have the greatest needs in the schools that serve most low-income students and students of color. So then we get inequities in access to fully prepared teachers across the country as well.
So are you saying, like, in Finland, the government, the country, is paying for teachers to go to extra college and get these master's degrees to be better teachers before they even go into the classroom?
That's right. That's right.
Okay. So then, do they pay their teachers better than we do? We'll use Finland as an example.
They do. And if you look at the international rankings of teacher salaries, the United States is generally on the very low end. Most of those high achieving countries, Finland and Singapore and others that you mentioned, pay teachers about as well as other college graduates. It's a 1-to-1 ratio. We pay at least 25% less to teachers. And that means, of course, that we always have shortages because if you graduate with a degree in math, and you could go off and, earn a lot of money in a tech company. You have to be really passionate to want to earn a lot less, put yourself through school to become a teacher. Thankfully, we have some very passionate and committed teachers, but we don't have enough of them to fill all of the vacancies. And we have about 400,000 vacancies right now in the United States that are counted by the states as unfilled with qualified.
400,000?
More than
Really?
400,000,
Wow.
yeah.
I had no idea. Okay, so I don't know what to do with that number, but okay, back to the paper we talked about earlier, how money matters for education outcomes. Not only does the U.S. have one of the highest poverty rates among developed countries, but as we talked about, the U.S. lacks these social support systems, universal health care, housing subsidies, even universal preschool. There's other countries that have universal preschool. So K-12 schools end up in the U.S., they end up carrying a larger share of the responsibility of helping children learn and grow. Talk to me about, I mean, the United States is not going to fix all of these factors: healthcare, housing, universal preschool. If you could, is there one that the United States could tackle and maybe take off of the burden from the K-12 schools?
Well, I do think that we have had moments where we've really made a dent in these things. When the American Rescue Plan Act was enacted at the start of the pandemic, there was a child tax credit that cut child poverty in half immediately over the course of that period of time. And that kind of thing should be enacted, generally. We could dramatically reduce child poverty, and that would have a huge effect both on schools and their costs and their capacity to be effective, and on the lives and school achievement of children. So that's one that's very much needed and possible to do. Healthcare is also possible, as we've seen. Many, many countries have universal healthcare plans. So it really depends on the policies that we take up in different administrations. Of course, we have the pendulum swing of changes from one administration to the other, which is another difference between us and many other countries that are much more stable, and they make gains and they continue to build on the gains that they've made before.
You also mentioned earlier that the United States has one of the most inequitable funded school systems because there's too much reliance on local property taxes. And then state funding rarely is able to equalize these things. So do you feel like, because you mentioned the American Rescue Plan twice, that it did a good job. So do you feel like the federal government needs to be playing more of a role here?
I do. I don't know that that's going to happen in the near term, but I do think there's an important federal role, and there have been moments in history where that role has been taken up really effectively. I really think back to the years of, Dwight Eisenhower, who was a general when he went into the presidency, thought that spending on education was more important than spending on the military, and he began a process that was picked up by Kennedy and by LBJ that really invested in our schools, and we saw great gains during that period of time. So it is possible to do with federal purpose, and I hope that will happen again. But I will say some states do a very good job. Our states are highly different. So you have states like Massachusetts and New Jersey with very progressive funding systems. They invest in their teachers, they invest in the education system to a greater extent, and they rank near the top of the world in student achievement. So there are ways that states can turn this around, and some of our states have done that.
So in places like Denmark and Sweden and Finland, does the country pay for everything? Are there no local property taxes there? Do you know?
There are, in some places, there are local add-ons that can be added. Often those are for the additional, recreation and things like that. In Finland, you only go to school for about, I think it's 5 hours a day, and the afternoon is always sports and recreation for the kids. And the local communities do a lot of things that can sometimes go add on to what the federal government does. But the education system itself is generally completely supported by the either federal system, or in large countries like Canada, the states or the provinces also take responsibility.
Well, that was my next question, was about the size. The United States is much larger than a Finland or a Sweden or a Denmark. So are we comparing apples to oranges when we try to compare the education systems?
Well, systems like Australia and Canada, China, which are large, all have state systems within them, as we do. And the federal government, in many cases, does contribute substantially, but the states have most of the responsibility for education, but there too, they centrally fund the schools in their province or their state, and add money for the needs of students, who are immigrant students or who are low-income students, so that they get the services that they need.
So in countries like Canada or Australia, do the states pay more of a share? Whereas here in the United States, the state pays a certain amount, but it tends to rely more on local property taxes.
Well, again, as I said, some states have changed that in the United States. So there are at least 12 or 15 states now where the state does take on the major share and does it equitably. But in many of our states, still, it is this sort of localized system that is still inequitable. And in other countries, you'll typically see the provincial government or the state government taking more of that responsibility.
Well, one thing before we run out of time, one thing we've been asking in this series is the question, is there a better way? So is there anything that comes to mind for you about a better way to fund schools in the U.S. that would be more practical than, suddenly having universal health care? Because,
Well, I will talk about for a moment what California's been doing in the last 10 years. California's been putting in place a very equitable funding system, so it sends more money to the schools that need it the most. But it has also started a massive investment in community schools, which are schools that provide the health care, the social service supports, a variety of things in collaboration with community organizations and so on. And we've just seen large increases in achievement for those schools, reductions in chronic absenteeism, reductions in suspension, better outcomes for kids in the places that are wrapping around the families and the students in a very purposeful way to make sure that when students come to school, they get what they need. And these schools are more efficient because they take all of the resources and create a very integrated approach rather than leaving families and kids to deal with 15 different bureaucracies to try to get what they need. So at the end of the day, we're saving money, and we're getting better outcomes by tackling that problem directly.
We've been talking about paying for K-12 schools in other countries versus the U.S. with Linda Darling Hammond, the Chief Knowledge Officer for the Learning Policy Institute. Linda, thank you so much for your time today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And coming up, we are going to learn how other states fund schools and how Ohio compares. That's when Untangled from All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
It's rare to find a podcast that can actually change your life. But when the show's called Life Kit, that's kind of the whole point. I'm Mariel Segarra. 3 times a week on the Life Kit podcast, we guide you through a topic we could all use help with, from personal development to healthy living to managing your dinero, with takeaways so you can start living what you learn right away. Escucha el Life Kit podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. This is Untangled, the Cost of Learning. This season, we are untangling, trying to explain, the cost of educating children. A national study on the fairness and adequacy of school funding found that Ohio ranked high in fiscal effort, but ranked low in closing the gap between high and low poverty school districts. The study looked at K-12 school finance in all 50 states plus D.C., and it says that every year, hundreds of billions of dollars in public funds are distributed based on 51 different configurations of formulas, rules, and regulations. So is there a state or two that does it better than the others, and what are some best practices in funding public schools? Bruce Baker is a professor in the Department of Teaching and Learning at the University of Miami. He's also the co-director and creator of the School Finance Indicators Database. Bruce, welcome to All Sides.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So your study says the key question is not just how much states and districts spend, it's whether it's enough. Is the funding adequate for students from all backgrounds to achieve common outcomes? That seems so difficult to measure. How do you determine if funding is enough?
Well, again, I think in that statement that you just read back to me, it's really not about just deciding on a dollar target. It's about deciding on what we want our public schooling systems to achieve on behalf of the students who attend them. So it's really about the outcomes and getting together to decide what's the level of outcomes we want to shoot for in kind of math, reading, science, kind of standard curricular areas of attainment, and what's the range of things we want all kids to be able to do. It starts with setting outcome goals, and from there, it moves to trying to figure out what it's going to cost to get to those outcome goals and how those costs are going to differ from one child to the next, one setting to the next, to be able to provide them all equal opportunity to get to those same outcome goals. So it starts with the outcomes, and then the cost to get there depends on the outcomes that we set, which is a little different than the way most kind of legislative and gubernatorial budgeting occurs, which starts with the amount of money we're willing to spend, and then we come up with a calculation of how we're going to divide it across all the kids and school systems, without necessarily any regard for what we want to achieve. We may have standards and outcomes we're shooting for, but we've not linked the two too often in state school funding formulas.
So your study shows Ohio is ranking high in fiscal effort. Can you tell me what that means, fiscal effort?
So we focus on a number of measures in the study. One is when we try to evaluate, when it comes to the adequacy of funding to achieve the outcomes, we try to also evaluate whether state funding is less than adequate because the state is simply lacking in the capacity to spend, or whether the state is less than adequate because it's just not trying. The measure of trying hard enough is we use two different measures, the percent of either the personal income of residents of the state or the percent of gross state product or GDP state as a measure of capacity. And Ohio spends slightly more than average percent of its capacity to fund K-12 education in combined state and local resources. So Ohio is trying. It's above that average. Ohio is trying less than it did in the earlier 2000s. And if it was trying as much as it did then, it would be raising more than 10% more per year than it is now. Most states dropped their effort after the Great Recession. Ohio is among them. So Ohio's still above average, but Ohio is putting up less effort than it did between 2000 and 2010.
The states that ranked the highest in this fiscal effort area were Wyoming and Alaska. I don't think of them as being on the lists of like having the best education in the country, but perhaps they do. Am I wrong?
Well, Vermont's up there too, and actually the three of those are up there for one of the main reasons they're up there is that it is so insanely costly to operate systems that consist only of tiny remote rural schools. And also depends on which measure you look at for Wyoming and Alaska. They have relatively high GDP, but not very high income, because Wyoming and Alaska have high values of natural resources to tap into. And Wyoming actually does have a fairly strong, robustly funded system. Alaska, less so. It's just insanely costly to try to fund the truly scattered, sparse system in Alaska. Wyoming has about as many kids as Vermont in a much bigger space than Vermont. Vermont's actually the one of the three that could put a lot more time and effort into reorganizing their schools so that it would cost them less to run an even higher quality system.
Your study also ranked Ohio as low in equal opportunity. So this is closing the gap between high and low poverty school districts. What does this mean for Ohio if we ranked low there, that we have too many districts that are really wealthy and too many that are not?
Right. So it's the problem in a state like Ohio, which is kind of similar in Pennsylvania, Illinois, Missouri, states that are carved up into a whole lot of districts where there are huge differences from one district to the next, often in the same space, whether it be around Cleveland, Columbus, or Cincinnati, or even some of the smaller, the second cities of the state, where you have such intense kind of racial and economic segregation from one neighborhood to the next, that changes kind of the cost profile of solving the equity problem. Mm-hmm. It becomes much more expensive to fund a very high poverty isolated, racially isolated district to provide those kids with equal opportunity to their neighbors who might only be a few streets away in an affluent suburb. So when you have a state that is so carved up by race, economic status, languages spoken and all that, like Ohio, solving the equal opportunity problem is harder. One other indicator that we've pulled back from in our reports is to look at how much more money is the state actually targeting to higher poverty settings to at least try to close that equal opportunity gap. Ohio does better than Missouri or Illinois or Pennsylvania in that regard, but the differences in need from one neighborhood to the next, one district mm-hmm. to the next, are so great in Ohio that even what they're doing is not enough. And the state itself actually funded a study this past year to look at the costs associated with concentrated child poverty.
This is Untangled from All Sides and WOSU, and we're talking about how states compare when it comes to paying for K-12 education. With us is Bruce Baker, a professor in the Department of Teaching and Learning at the University of Miami. So which states overall, you know, because we talked about how Wyoming and Alaska do a good job, but they have the natural resources, that kind of thing. But in the previous part of the show, we were talking with a woman who has studied this in different countries and also in different states. And she cited Massachusetts and New Jersey as being the states that do a good job. But maybe your study doesn't rank them quite that way. What would you say? What are some states that have this figured out and are doing a good job in school funding?
Well, nobody's perfect.
Yeah.
Nobody really has it figured out, but I would actually agree. I'm curious as to who you spoke with, but I would agree that Massachusetts and New Jersey are two that have tried more than many others to over time target more resources to areas of higher need, higher poverty concentration, higher concentrations of children for whom English is a second language. Mm-hmm. If you're going to close the equal opportunity gap, you've got to have the will and the resources to target more and enough more to those schools, cities, towns that have the greater costs to provide equal opportunity. And now, New Jersey and Massachusetts were both at their best in the early 2000s. Hmm. And they've fallen off since then. So historically, they've done fairly well. Their average level of funding is pretty good. Their outcomes are pretty good to go along with that. I hadn't looked at the Ohio data in a while. Ohio has kind of kept its pace as being among the better options as well, in that its funding is still relatively more adequate than most states. And the state continues to target more resources when you include the federal funding to higher need districts. But even the study that was done for the state found that state local funding was lower in higher need districts than it was in lower need districts. So yeah, Massachusetts and New Jersey are two pretty good examples, but they're anything but perfect.
Yeah.
And neither one is anywhere near it was 10, 15 years ago.
In the previous part of the show, we talked with Linda Darling-Hammond with the Learning Policy Institute. I don't know if you know. I don't know if all education finance people know each other. But, okay, so I did want to talk about the idea of Wyoming and Alaska are using money from the natural resources to pay for educating kids, and they rank as doing a good job. So does Ohio need to find oil under Toledo or something? Is that going to help and fix everything?
But it doesn't hurt, right? Or natural gas or whatever. But, but it's, you know, that's one of the unevennesses. One of the things that's just uneven across states, right? The access to things like natural resources, just like, you know, there are things that are vastly unequal across districts within states, like taxable property wealth, mm-hmm. Which is what creates the internal problem. You know, it's always good to be looking at what other resources might be tapped in terms of tax revenue, keeping in mind that you want it to be something that can be equitably taxed, and you want it to be a source of revenue that is stable over time, one of the benefits of the property tax revenues is that the relatively stable income tax revenues are much more volatile when something like the Great Recession hits. Ohio, based on my quick scan of my own data right before we talked here, Ohio has become more dependent on property tax revenue and less dependent on income tax revenue since the Great Recession, more dependent on sales tax revenue, which is a little more stable than the income tax revenue. But I don't know, you know, what the other sources would be that might provide new opportunities in Ohio. I'm also doing global work and looking at how nations like Gambia can generate natural resource funds, really to create an endowment to get the ball rolling, which is something that may become more necessary as states face the possibility of losing substantial federal aid.
The big problem we've been having in recent years here in Ohio is that the state share, some say the state share is not high enough for what they're paying for schools, and there's an over-reliance on property taxes. So property taxes make up a larger percentage of what's going to school districts than what the state is paying. And that's a big part of the problem, you know, because property taxes in an affluent area are higher than that in a poorer or more rural area. So are you finding that a lot of states are over-reliant on property taxes, or is Ohio unique in this aspect?
Ohio is not really unique. I mean, the Great Recession created this flip. A lot of states from the late 90s up to about 2007, 2008, put more funding into their state aid formulas, drove more funding out to school districts that was from state sources derived from income and sales taxes. After the Great Recession, where that really receded, you know, substantially, states became more dependent on property taxes. But I would say that the end result, whether increased dependence on property taxes results in greater inequality across districts, depends on how well the state targets its state resources. And Ohio may have become more dependent on property taxes, but at least it was seemingly targeting its state resources better than some other states to mitigate the inequities that would be associated with property taxes alone. But it really looks like most of their gains in targeting money to higher need areas came from federal aid in recent years under the COVID relief aid. And when that's gone, we may get an uglier picture of what's going on across Ohio districts. Again, Ohio funding is relatively progressive in the last few years, targeted in greater amounts to districts with greater needs, but it appears to be because of the federal aid, not the state and local.
Yeah, you'll have different numbers for us to talk about in a few years once you can figure this all out, because obviously, right, with what's happening with the Trump administration, the federal money is going to change, but it hasn't quite yet.
And the state will need to find, if the state really wants to close equal opportunity gaps as that federal aid gets pulled back, the state's going to have to put more effort into targeting state resources to the higher need districts, be they the larger cities, the second cities, or even remote rural towns in many cases, which have relatively high child poverty.
Your study cites states such as, I'm just going to call out a few, Florida, North Carolina, and Nevada are all ranked pretty low. Do you feel like Ohio should just be happy to be in the middle? Is it the middle a good place to be? It's better than the bottom if you can't reach the top?
Well, it's certainly better than being in Arizona or Florida, right? But it's, you know, it's not, I think, really, to me, what it means is that their cost of doing even better, their gap between where they're at now and really providing more equal opportunity to all kids across the state, their gap is much smaller than the gap that needs to be filled in some of these other states. So it's not as costly to get there in Ohio over, let's say, a 5-year span. The first few years of that may be just replacing whatever role the federal government has played. So I think it's always important to strive for more. I think another point I would make about Ohio compared to, say, Florida is because they reduced their effort from about 10, 15 years ago, but Ohio has held more steady since and has kept money targeted to areas of greater need in recent years, and Ohio's national assessment scores on reading didn't continue dropping at the same pace in the most recent biennial cycle. And the math scores actually rebounded, whereas states like Florida that have continued to pull back their effort in a race to the bottom, Florida's eighth grade scores have just continued to plummet as fast as they did during COVID and before COVID. So, I think we've seen some positives even on the outcome side, and that Ohio kids, like those in New Jersey or Massachusetts, have seen a rebound on their math scores in the most recent biennial cycle. So they, you know, should take some comfort in the fact that the spending matters. And we have a lot of research that also shows that.
Well, we only have about a minute left, but I did want to ask you, there's so much debate over school funding in this country, and it's been a big debate here in Ohio. And one thing we've been asking everyone in this series is the question, is there a better way? Is there anything that comes to mind for you, since you do all the studying of all the states, of it, what is the best way or a better way to do this?
Yeah, I think, again, like conceptually, what I laid out in the beginning, that we've got to decide what outcomes we want all kids to achieve. And then we have to find a way to link the amount we're going to spend from one school, one kid to the next, to the outcomes we want to achieve, and continue to measure that over time. And rather than making the budget decision in some space that's completely independent of the decision about the outcomes. We can't just say, here's how much money you're going to get, achieve these outcomes or be penalized. We need to set the money, calibrate the money to the outcomes. Some states have done more work on that than others and built their formulas more around that. But again, nobody's perfect. And Ohio is in kind of the upper half on that. And Ohio has also engaged outside research. I was part of the study that looked at the cost modeling associated to poverty concentrations in Ohio. So I think they've made some reasonable efforts and are in better shape than a lot of other states.
All right. We've been talking about school funding in Ohio and other states with Bruce Baker, a professor in the Department of Teaching and Learning at the University of Miami. He's also the co-director and creator of the School Finance Indicators Database. Thank you so much for your time today, Bruce.
Thank you.
And coming up, we're going to talk about some new and innovative ways to pay for schools. That is when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Rare to find a podcast that can actually change your life. But when the show's called Life Kit, that's kind of the whole point. I'm Mariel Segarra. 3 times a week on the Life Kit podcast, we guide you through a topic we could all use help with, from personal development to healthy living to managing your dinero, with takeaways so you can start living what you learn right away. Escucha el Life Kit podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. This is Untangled, a show from All Sides and WOSU, where we take a complicated topic and untangle it for you, explain it in a way that's easier to understand. And we've been tackling the cost of learning. In the United States, K-12 schools' money is largely controlled by states. Every year, hundreds of billions of dollars are distributed to 13,000 school districts, and each state does it in a different way. This hour, we've been talking about how other countries pay for kids' education. Then we talked about how different states pay for it. And now we're going to see if there are any new and innovative ways that the money could be handed out. Zahava Stadler is project director of the Education Funding Equity Initiative at New America, a progressive national policy and research organization. Zahava, welcome to All Sides.
Thank you so much for having me.
So I have to say, from researching in this series, our education funding system is quite a tangled mess in the United States. Do you see it as a mess? Is that the right word?
I see it as 50 messes. I think that it's really important that you off the top said that the way schools are funded in the US is largely governed by states. I think that's really important because there's no federal right to a public education, but every single state constitution mentions a right to public schooling. And so it really is on states to make sure that kids have a fairly resourced public education. Some states are stepping up on this. But everybody is really struggling, I think, in this economic moment to think about how to make sure that we can recession-proof our schools and make sure that our kids have the opportunities they need in this difficult moment.
So a long time ago, the federal government decided that educating kids would be a state issue and not a federal issue. But I do wonder if there should be more of a federal role in this. I mean, would that help if the federal government was more involved?
I think it would help. I hopefully don't have to convince public radio listeners right now that federal funding can be a really important way of keeping things healthy and moving, and that federal funding cuts can be a big threat. But right now, we're not looking at the prospect of an increased federal role. We're looking at the prospect of massive federal funding cuts. And so I think what states are doing right now is thinking about how to triage in the face of these big cuts. And I will just say right now, the president's budget that the administration has proposed for fiscal year 2026 would cut about $35 million from schools in the average congressional district. The House Republicans have proposed a budget that would cut even more, about $41 million from schools in each congressional district. And not only that, the House budget would take an absolute chainsaw to the Title I funding that supports kids in poverty. So the federal funding has played a really important role in the past. Right now, the people in power are looking to shrink that role at a time when we actually need it more than ever.
So, do you feel since all 50 states run their education systems differently and fund them differently, if all 50 states end up losing this federal money that you're talking about, will all 50 states try to fix that in a different way? Is that what we're facing?
I think some states will try to fix it, and some states will try to manage the bleeding, but may not see support for vulnerable students as their highest priority. And that's a very dangerous prospect right now. I do think they will be managing it in different ways. I think the important thing to remember is that there are actually three levels of government involved here. There's federal money, there's state money and state policy, and there's also local money in public schools. And a lot of times, state policymakers treat that local money like it's not their business. We all know that there's a lot of inequality on the ground. Different communities are able to raise different amounts of local money for schools because most of it is property taxes, and property taxes don't generate the same amount of money everywhere. If you have a district that's full of mansions, you'll generate more money than if you have a district that's full of old and tiny homes. And there are states, on the whole, state policy on the whole treats this as though it's not state lawmakers' problem, and that is absolutely not true. Every state has laws on the books about how local jurisdictions can raise money for schools, how much they have to, how much they can at a minimum and maximum. And it's time for states to realize that this is a really important part of the school funding system, and they need to get involved.
The most recent budget cycle here in Ohio, property taxes became a huge debate because the property taxes going to school districts is much higher than what the states pay. So property taxes pay more than the state of Ohio. And people in Ohio, whether they want a good education system or not, they want their property taxes to go down. So the state has been saying that the districts have too much in the rainy day funds. They have too much administration. And so the state want here in Ohio, the state wants the districts to be more fiscally responsible to lower property taxes. What do you make of that?
I think it's a cop out. I would say right now, the more you put the onus on local school districts, the more you are just deferring to the inequality that exists on the ground. Right now, if every school district in Ohio levied a 1% property tax for education, just to make the math easy, the richest districts in the country, the richest quartile of districts in Ohio would raise about $11,000 per pupil from that 1% property tax. The property poorest quartile of districts in Ohio would raise about $2,500. That is a massive, massive gap. The more the state says that this is a local problem, the more the state is saying, hey, inequality is not our business. That really isn't true. It's not true as a matter of the Constitution in the state. It's not true as a matter of the needs of kids in the state. And there are things that the state could be doing to rebalance that, really starting with rethinking what it means to be a local school district in Ohio. Right now, Ohio has about 600 school districts, well above the national average. So school districts are divided up into these very tiny little jurisdictions that can be very unequal on the ground. They encompass small neighborhoods with very local tax bases. And if the state were to think differently about redistricting their school districts to encompass a fairer tax base per pupil, they could massively improve the equity of the system and buffer local schools against state cuts. So this is something that I think is a newer idea in school finance. You were asking at the top, are there any innovative ideas? Ohio is a state that's actually done a lot of tweaks to its state allocations recently, made a lot of changes to how state money is handed out. It has not made a lot of changes or really thought that much about how to make sure the local money in the system is more equitable. My team actually has a report coming out later this week about redistricting school districts for equity and for fairness and for thinking about how we can get more diverse school districts supported by fairer tax bases. In Ohio, this is really possible. And it's something where, with the right borders, you could cut inequality in the tax base by almost three quarters without moving any kids, without changing the value of any houses, just by moving these imaginary lines that separate kids from the resources that they need. That is absolutely possible, and it is within the power of state lawmakers right now.
This is Untangled from All Sides in WOSU, and we're talking about equity in education funding with Zahava Stadler, the project director of the Education Funding Equity Initiative at New America. This idea of combining school districts has been discussed a lot. Especially here in Ohio, we have, I think it's 611 school districts. That's a lot of districts for this state. But the idea for state lawmakers to, you know, just the love of the sports associated with the districts and the communities, I think that it would be politically hard to combine them together. Do you find that in some states? Do they have problems making these hard choices?
Yeah, I think it is really hard to do. I'm not denying that, but it should be seen as harder to show up every single year and underserve kids. It should be seen as a political non-starter every year to raise people's property taxes without helping their children learn better. It should be seen as a political non-starter to have communities where the quartile districts with the most students of color have about 35% students of color, and the quartile with the fewest students of color have about 1%. That massive racial segregation is another thing that we could address through redistricting, and that is the case in Ohio. I think that people have a big status quo bias here. They have an attachment to what they've always known, but there was no master plan that created Ohio's 600 some school districts now. They kind of grew up over time around communities in ways that don't reflect what kids need and don't reflect any larger purpose. And it really should be a bigger political liability to leave things as they are, given how poorly the current arrangement is serving kids.
Another thing that I found whenever I was just looking around for new and innovative ideas for funding school districts, ways for school districts to find alternative funding streams, there's a bunch of lists out there. One that struck me had listed on it corporate sponsorships, crowdfunding, and facility rental. Do things like that raise enough money to help?
That's a real find your pennies in the couch cushion approach to funding schools. I think that if we were looking at a time when it would be nice to get a little extra money, then those would be a reasonable approach to getting a little extra money. That's not the situation we're in. The big federal cuts that are coming down, and I don't just mean to schools, I mean there are big cuts that have already been legislated to federal health care and food assistance programs. Those are going to hit state budgets really hard in the next couple of years. And absent some really creative solutions, states are going to be hard pressed to keep their education funding healthy and sustainable in light of the other hits that the state budget is taking. So we're in a position where the state is staring down a really big budget crisis born of federal policy changes. And they're going to need to think creatively about supporting schools and helping schools support themselves through better and more and fairer local funding if we're going to weather what is a real crisis. So this is, we're not going to bake sale our way out of this problem.
Well, we have about 90 seconds left, but in this series, I've been asking everyone what the best way forward is. Like, is there a better way to do this? So the one example you gave was combining school districts together, having fewer school districts. Is there another better way that you'd like to tell me about?
At the end of the day, what happens right now is we let our school funding system be built on this massively unequal foundation, and then the state has to run really hard to try and compensate for ground level inequalities. The bigger picture priority here is trying to solve those things at ground level. These are problems that don't need to exist at the source, whether it's school funding redistricting, intentional integration efforts, or the state bearing greater responsibility for funding from the beginning instead of relying so heavily on unequal local funding. We need to focus less on compensating for the problem and more on solving it.
You've been listening to Zahava Stadler, the project director of the Education Funding Equity Initiative at New America, a progressive national policy and research organization. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And this is Untangled from All Sides in WOSU. Be sure to subscribe to the Untangled podcast so you don't miss any episodes. Next time, we're going to talk about the history of paying for schools, from the founding of this country to how we ended up with the system that we have right now. For Untangled and All Sides, I'm Amy Jarovich. This is 89.7 NPR News.